He said that in a few days' time one or two planes, smaller planes, would arrive at Chongqing. They were planes, he told me, which had been purchased from the Americans. After that I had little thought in my head beyond flying. How could I get to one of these craft? How could I make it go up in the air? How could I learn to fly? Huang and I were leaving the hospital a few days later when out of the heavy clouds stretching above our heads darted two silver shapes, two single-seater fighter planes which had come from Shanghai as promised. They circled over Chongqing, and circled again. Then, as if they had just spotted exactly where to land, they dived down in close formation. We wasted no time. We hurried down the street of steps, and made our way across to the sand. There were two Chinese pilots standing beside their machines, busily engaged in polishing off marks of their flight through dirty clouds. Huang and I approached them, and made our presence known to the leader of the two, a Captain Boku. Huang had made it very clear to me that nothing would induce him to go up into the air again. He had thought that he would die after his first, and last, flight. Captain Boku said, "Ah, yes, I have heard about you. I was actually wondering how to get in touch with you. And I was much flattered thereby." We talked for a time. He pointed out the differences between this machine and the passenger machine which we had seen before. This, as he pointed out, was a machine with a single seat, and one engine, but the other had been a three-engine type. We had little time to stay then, because we had to deal with our rounds, and it was with extreme reluctance that we left. The next day we had half a day off and we made our way again, as early as possible, to the two planes. I asked the captain when he was going to teach me to fly as promised. He said, "Oh, I could not possibly do that. I am just here by order of Chiang Kai-shek. We are showing these planes." I kept on at him for that day, and when I saw him the day after he said, "You can sit in the machine, if you like. You will find that quite satisfying. Sit in and try the controls. This is how they work, look." And he stood on the wing root and pointed out the controls to me, showed me how they worked. They were much the same as those of the three-engine machine, but of course much simpler. That evening we took him and his companion, they left a guard of police on the machine, to the temple which was our home, and although I worked on them very hard I could not get any statement at all about when they were going to teach me to fly. He said, "Oh, you may have to wait a long time. It takes months of training. It's impossible to fly a thing straight off as you want to. You would have to go to ground school. You would have to fly in a dual-seat machine, and you would have to do many hours before you were allowed in a plane such as ours." The next day at the end of the afternoon we went down again. Huang and I crossed the river and landed on the sand. The two men were quite alone with their machine. The two machines were many yards apart. Apparently there was something wrong with that of Boku's friend, because he had got the engine cowling off, and tools were all over the place. Boku himself had the engine of his machine turning over. He was adjusting it. He stopped it, made an adjustment, and started it again. It went fut 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 and did not run at all evenly. He was oblivious to us, as he stood on the wing, and fiddled about with the engine. Then, as the motor purred evenly, smoothly, like a well-pleased cat, he straightened up, wiping his hands on a piece of oily waste. He looked happy. He was turning to speak to us when his companion called urgently to him from the other plane. Boku went to stop the motor but the other pilot waved his hands frantically, so he just dropped to the ground from the wing and hurried off. I looked at Huang. I said, "Aha, he said I could sit in, did he not? Well, I will sit in." "Lobsang," said Huang, "you are not thinking of anything rash, are you?"
"Not at all," I replied. "I could fly that thing. I know all about it."
"But, man," said Huang, "you'll kill yourself."
"Rubbish," I said. "Haven't I flown kites? Haven't I been up in the air, and been free from air sickness?"
Poor Huang looked a bit crestfallen at that because his own airmanship was not at all good. I looked toward the other plane, but the two pilots were far too busy to bother with me. They were kneeling on the sand doing something to part of an engine. Obviously, they were quite engrossed. There was no one else about except Huang,
So, I walked up to the plane. As I had seen the others do, I kicked away the chocks in front of the wheels and hastily jumped in as the plane began to roll. The controls had been explained to me a few times and I knew which was the throttle. I knew what to do. I slammed it hard forward, hard against the stop, so hard that I nearly sprained my left wrist. The engine roared under full power as if it would tear itself free. Then we were off, absolutely speeding down that strip of yellow sand. I saw a flash where water and sand met. For a moment I felt panic, then I remembered, pulled back. I pulled back on the control column hard, the nose rose, the wheels just kissed the waves and made spray. We were up. It felt as if an immense, powerful hand was pressing beneath me, pushing me up. The engine roared and I thought, must not let it go too fast, must throttle it back or it will fall to pieces. So I pulled the throttle control a quarter way back and the engine note became less. I looked over the side of the plane, and it quite a shock. A long way below were the white cliffs of Chongqing. I was high, really high, so high that I could hardly pick out where I was. I was getting higher all the time. White cliffs, of Chongqing? Where? Goodness. If I go any higher I shall fly out of the world, I thought. Just then there was a terrible shuddering and I felt as if I was falling to pieces. The control in my hand was wrenched from my grasp. I was flung against the side of the machine which tilted, and lurched violently, and went spinning down to earth. For a moment I knew utter fright. I said to myself, "You've done it this time, Lobsang, my boy. You've been too clever for yourself. A few more seconds and they'll scrape you off the rock." Oh, why did I ever leave Tibet? Then I reasoned out from what I had heard and from my kite flying experience. A spin, controls cannot operate, I must give full throttle to try and get some directional control. No sooner had I thought of it than I pushed the throttle right forward again, and the engine roared anew. Then I grabbed the wildly threshing control and braced myself against the back of the seat. With my hands and my knees I forced that control forward. The nose dropped startlingly, as if the bottom had fallen out of the world. I had no safety belt and if I had not been clinging on very tightly to the controls I would have been shot out. It felt as if there were ice in my veins, as if someone was pushing snow down my back. My knees became strangely weak, the engine roared, the whine getting higher and higher. I was bald, but I am sure that had I not been the hair would have stood absolutely on end in spite of the airstream. Ouch, fast enough, I said to myself, and it gently, oh, so gently, in case it broke off, I eased back that control. Gradually, terrifying slowly, the nose came up, and up, but in my excitement I forgot to level off. Up went the nose until the strange feeling made me look down, or was it up? I found the whole earth was above my head. For a moment I was completely at a loss to know what had happened. Then the plane gave a lurch and turned over into a dive again, so that the earth, the hard world beneath, was directly in front of the propeller. I had turned a somersault. I had flown upside down, braced on hands and knees in the cockpit, hanging upside down with no safety belt, and definitely without much hope. I admit I was frightened, but I thought, well, if I can stay on the back of a horse, I can stay in a machine. So I let the nose drop some more and then gradually pulled back the stick. Again I felt as if a mighty hand was pushing me, this time, though, I pulled back the stick slowly, carefully, watching the ground all the time, and I was able to level off the plane in even flight. For a moment or two I just sat there, mopping the perspiration from my brow, thinking what a terrible affair it had been, first going straight down, then going straight up, then flying upside down, and now I did not know where I was. I looked over the side, I peered at the ground, I turned round and round, and I hadn't got the vaguest idea where I was. I might have been in the Gobi Desert. At last, when I had just about given up hope, inspiration struck me, just about everything in the cockpit had as well exclamation mark the river, where was it? Obviously, I thought, if I can find the river then I either go left or right, eventually I will go somewhere. So I turned the plane in a gentle circle, peering into the distance. At last I saw a faint silver thread on the horizon. I turned the plane in that direction, and kept it there. I pushed forward the throttle to get there more quickly, and then I pulled the throttle back again in case something broke off with all the noise I was making. I wasn't feeling too happy at this time. I had found that I was doing everything in extremes. I had pushed forward the throttle, the nose would rise with alarming rapidity, or I would pull back the throttle and the nose would fall with even more alarming suddenness. So now I was trying everything. Gently, it was a new attitude which I had adopted for the occasion. When I was right over it, I turned again, and flew along that river, seeking the cliffs of Chongqing. It was most bewildering. I could not find the place. Then I decided to come lower. Lower I circled, and circled, peering over the side looking for those white cliffs with the gashes which were the steep steps, looking for the terraced fields. They were hard to find. At last it dawned upon me that all those little specks on the river were the ships about Chongqing. A little paddle steamer, the sampans, and the junks. So I went lower still. Then I saw a mere sliver of sand. Down I went spiraling down like a hawk spiraling down in search of prey. The sandy spit became larger, and larger. Three men were looking up, petrified with horror, three men, Boku and his fellow pilot and Huang, feeling quite certain, as they later told me, that they had lost a plane. But now I was fairly confident, too confident. I had got up in the air, I had flown upside down, I had found Chongqing. Now, I thought I am the world's best pilot. Just then I had an itch in my left leg where there was a bad scar from the time when I was burned in the Lamaserie. Unconsciously I suppose I twitched my leg, the plane rocked, a tornado of wind struck my left cheek, the nose went down as the wing tilted, and soon I was in a screaming sideslip. Once again I pushed forward the throttle and gingerly pulled back on the control column. The plane shuddered and the wings vibrated. I thought they were going to fall off. By a miracle they held. The plane bucked like an angry horse, and then slid into level flight. My heart was fairly pounding at the effort and with the fright. I flew again in a circle over the little patch of sand. Well, now, I thought to myself, I've got to land the thing. How am I going to do that? The river here was a mile wide. To me it looked as if it was inches and the little patch on which I had to land was diminutive. I circled wondering what to do. Then I remembered what they had told me, how they had explained flying. So I looked for some smoke to see which way the wind was blowing, because they had told me I had to land into wind. It was blowing upriver, I saw by a bonfire which had been lit on the bank of the river. I turned and flew upstream, up many miles, and then I reversed my course, so that I was facing downriver and into wind. As I flew towards Chongqing I gradually eased back the throttle so that I was going slower and slower, and so that the plane would sink and sink. Once I eased it back too much, and the machine stalled and rocked, and dropped like a stone, leaving my heart and stomach, or so it felt, hanging on a cloud. Very quickly indeed I pushed forward the throttle and pulled back the control column, but I had to turn round again and make my way upriver once more, and start all over again. I was getting tired of this flying business, and wishing that I had never started it at all. It was one thing, I thought, to get it up in the air, but a very different thing to get down, in one piece. The roaring of the engine was becoming monotonous. I was thankful to see Chongqing coming in sight again. I was low now, going slowly, just above the river, between huge rocks which often looked white, but now, through the oblique rays of the sun, looked a greenish black. As I approached the sandy spit in the middle of the Tanaro River, I could have done with several miles of width exclamation mark. I saw three figures hopping up and down with excitement. I was so interested watching them that I just forgot all about landing. By the time it had occurred to me that this was the place I had to alight, it had passed beneath my wheels, beneath the tail skid. So, with a sigh of weary resignation, I pushed that hated throttle forward to gain speed. I pulled back on the control to gain height, and went over in a sharp left swing. Now I was facing upriver again, sick of the scenery, sick of Chongqing, sick of everything. I turned once more downriver, and into wind. Across to the right I saw a beautiful sight. The sun was going down and it was red, red and huge. Going down. It reminded me that I had to go down too, and I thought I would go down and crash and die, and I felt to myself that I was not yet ready to join the gods. There was so much to be done. This reminded me of the prophecy and I knew that I had nothing more to worry about. The prophecy. Of course I would land safely and all would be well. Thinking of that almost made me forget Zhongqing. Here, it was nearly beneath the left wing. I gently eased on the rudder bar to make sure that the sandy spit of yellow sand was dead in front of the engine. I slowed down more and more. The plane gradually sank. I pulled back the throttle so that I was about 10 feet above the water as the engine note died. To be sure that there was no fire if I crashed, I switched off the engine. Then, very, very gently, I pushed forward the control column to lose more height. Straight in front of the engine I saw sand and water as if I was aiming directly at it. So gently I pulled back the control column, there was a dug, and a jar, then a bounce. Once again a scraping noise, a dug, and a jar, and then a rumbling creak as if everything was falling to pieces. I was on the ground. The plane had just about landed itself. For a moment I sat quite still, hardly believing that it was all over, that the noise of the engine was not really there, but that it was just imagination in my ears. Then I looked around. Boku and his companion and Huang came racing up, red in the face with the effort, breathless. They skidded to a stop just beneath me. Boku looked at me, looked at the plane, looked at me again. Then he went really pale-faced with shock and utter relief. He was so relieved that he was quite unable to be angry. After a long, long interval Boku said, "That settles it. You will have to join the force or I shall get into very serious trouble." "All right," I said, "suits me fine. There's nothing in this flying business. But I would like to learn the approved method." Boku turned red in the face again, and then laughed. "You're a born pilot, Lobsang Rampa," he said. "You'll get your chance to learn to fly." So that was the first step toward leaving Zhongqing. As a surgeon and as a pilot my services would be of use elsewhere. Later in the day, when we were talking over the whole matter, I asked Boku why, if he had been so worried, he did not come up in the other plane to show me the way back. He said, "I wanted to, but you had flown off with the starter and all, so I could not." Huang, of course, spread the story, as did Boku and his companion, and for several days I was the talk of the college and of the hospital, much to my disgust. Dr. Li sent for me officially to administer a severe reprimand, but officially to congratulate me. He said that he would have liked to have done a thing like that himself in his younger years, but there were no aircraft in my young days, Rampa. We had to go by horse or by foot. He said that now it fell to the lot of a wild Tibetan to give him the best thrill that he had had for years. He added, "Rampa, what did the auroras look like as you flew over them and they thought that you were going to crash on them?" He had to laugh as I said that they looked completely terrified and their auroras had contracted to a pale blue blot, shot through with maroon red streaks. I said, "I am glad there was no one there to see what my aura was like. It must have been terrible." Certainly it felt so. Not so long after this I was approached by a representative of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek and offered the opportunity to learn to fly properly and be commissioned in the Chinese forces. The officer who came to me said, "If we have time before the Japanese invade seriously, we would like to establish a special corps so that those people who are injured and cannot be moved can receive help from men of the air who are also surgeons." So it came about that I had other things to study beside human bodies. I had to study oil's circulation as well as the circulation of the blood. I had to study the framework of aircraft as well as the skeletons of humans. They were of equal interest and they had many points in common. So the years went on, and I became a qualified doctor and a qualified pilot, trained in both, working in a hospital and flying in my spare time. Huang dropped out of it. He was not interested in flying and the mere thought of a plane made him turn pale. Boku, instead, stayed with me because it had been seen how well we got on together and we made indeed a satisfactory team. Flying was a wonderful sensation. It was glorious to be high up in an aeroplane, and to switch off the engine and to glide and to soar in the way that the birds did. It was so much like astral traveling, which I do and which anyone else can do provided their heart is reasonably healthy and they will have the patience to persevere. Do you know what astral traveling is? Can you recall the pleasures of soaring, of drifting over the housetop, going across the oceans, perhaps, to some far distant land? We can all do it. It is merely when the more spiritual part of the body casts aside its physical covering, and world of the end of its silver cord. There is nothing magical about it, nothing wrong. It is natural and wholesome, and in days gone by all men could travel astrally without let or hindrance. The adepts of Tibet and many of India travel in their astral from place to place, and there is nothing strange in it. In religious books the world over, the Bibles of all religions, there is mention of such things as the silver cord and the golden bowl. This so-called silver cord is merely a shaft of energy, radiant energy, which is capable of infinite extension. It is not a material cord like a muscle, or artery, or piece of string, but it is life itself, is the energy which connects the physical body and the astral body. Man has many bodies. For the moment we are interested only in the physical and in the next stage, the astral. We may think that when we are in a different state we can walk through walls, or fall through floors. We can, but we can only walk or fall through floors of a different density. In the astral stage things of this everyday world are no barrier to our passage. Doors of a house would not keep one in or keep one out. But in the astral world there are also doors and walls which to us in the astral are as solid, as containing, as the doors and walls of this earth are to the physical body. Have you seen a ghost? If so, it was probably an astral entity, perhaps an astral projection of someone you know, or someone visiting you from another part of the world. You may, at some time, have had a particularly vivid dream. You may have dreamed that you were floating like a balloon, up into the sky, held by a string, a cord. You may have been able to look down from the sky, from the other end of this cord, and have found that your body was rigid, pallid, immovable. If you kept at that disconcerting sight, you may have found yourself floating, floating off, drifting like a piece of thistle down on a breeze. A little later you may have found yourself in some distant land, or some remote district known to you. If you thought anything about it in the morning you would probably put it down as a dream. It was astral traveling. Try this, when you go to sleep at night think vividly that you are going to visit someone you know well. Think of how you are going to visit that person. It may be someone in the same town. Well, as you are lying down keep quite still, relaxed, at ease. Shut your eyes and imagine yourself floating off the bed, out through the window, and floating over the street, knowing that nothing can hurt you, knowing that you cannot fall. In your imagination follow the exact line that you will take, street by street, until you get to the house that you want. Then imagine how you are going to enter the house. Doors do not bother you now, remember, nor do you have to knock. You will be able to see your friend, the person whom you have come to visit. That is, you will be able to if your motives are pure. There is no difficulty at all, nothing dangerous, nothing harmful. There is only one law, your motives must be pure. Here it is again, repetition if you like. But it is much better to approach it from one or two viewpoints so that you can see how utterly simple this is. As you lie upon your bed, alone with no one to disturb you, with your bedroom door locked so that no one can come in, keep calm. Imagine that you are gently disengaging from your body. There is no harm, nothing can hurt you. Imagine that you hear various little creaks and that there are numerous jolts, small jolts, as your spiritual force leaves the physical and solidifies above. Imagine that you are forming a body, the exact counterpart of your physical body, and that it is floating above the physical, weightlessly. You will experience a slight swaying, a minute rise and fall. There is nothing to be afraid of, there is nothing to worry about. This is natural, harmless. As you keep calm you will find that gradually your now freed spirit will drift until you float a few feet off. Then you can look down at yourself, at your physical body. You will see that your physical and your astral bodies are connected by a shining silver cord, a bluish silver cord, which pulsates with life, with the thoughts that go from physical to astral, and from astral to physical. Nothing can hurt you so long as your thoughts are pure. Nearly everyone has had an experience of astral traveling. Cast your mind back and think if you can remember this. Have you ever been asleep and had the impression that you were swaying, falling, falling, and then you awoke with a jolt just before you crashed into the ground? That was astral traveling done the wrong way. The unpleasant way. There is no need for you to suffer that inconvenience or unpleasantness. It was caused by the difference in vibration between the physical and the astral bodies. It may have been that when you were floating down to enter the physical body after making a journey, some noise, some draft, or some interruption, caused a slight discrepancy in position and the astral body came down to the physical body not exactly in the right position, so there was a jolt, a jar. You can liken it to stepping off a moving bus. The bus, which is, let us say, the astral body, is doing 10 miles an hour. The ground, which we will call the physical body, does not move. In the short space between leaving the bus platform and hitting the ground, you have to slow down or experience a jerk. So, if you have had this falling sensation, then you have had astral traveling even if you did not know it, because the jerk of coming back to what one would call a bad landing would erase the memory of what you did, of what you saw. In any event, without training you could have been asleep when you were astral traveling. So you would have merely thought that you had dreamed. I dreamed last night that I visited such and such a place, and saw so and so. How many times have you said that? All a dream. But was it? With a little practice you can do astral traveling when you are fully awake and you can retain the memory of what you saw, and what you did. The big disadvantage of course with astral traveling is just this: when you travel in the astral you can take nothing with you, nor can you take anything back, so it is a waste of time to think that you will go somewhere by astral traveling, because you cannot even take money, not even a handkerchief, but only your spirit. People with bad hearts should not practice astral traveling. For them it could be dangerous. But there is no danger whatever for those with sound hearts, because so long as our motives are pure, so long as you do not contemplate evil or gain over another, no harm whatever can happen. Do you want to travel astrally? This is the easiest way to set about it. First of all, remember this: it is the first law of psychology, and it stipulates that in any battle between the will and the imagination always wins. So always imagine that you can do a thing, and if you imagine it strongly enough you can do it. You can do anything. Here is an example to make it clear. Anything that you really imagine you can do, that you can do, no matter how difficult or impossible it is to the onlooker. Anything which your imagination tells you is impossible, then, to you it is impossible no matter how much your will tries to force you on. Think of it in this way: there are two houses 35 feet high, and 10 feet apart. A plank is stretched between them at roof level. The plank is, perhaps, 2 feet wide. If you want to walk across that plank, your imagination would cause you to picture all the hazards, the wind causing you to sway, or perhaps something in the wood causing you to stumble. You might, your imagination says, become giddy, but no matter the cause, your imagination tells you that the journey would be impossible for you, you would fall and be killed. Well, no matter how hard you try, if you once imagine that you cannot do it, then do it you cannot, and that simple little walk across the plank would be an impossible journey for you. No amount of willpower at all would enable you to cross safely. Yet, if that plank was on the ground you could walk its length without the slightest hesitation. Which wins in a case like this? Willpower? Or imagination? Again, if you imagine that you can walk the plank between the two houses, then you can do it easily. It does not matter at all if the wind is blowing or even if the plank shakes, so long as you imagine that you can cross safely. People walk tight ropes. Perhaps they even cross on a cycle. But no willpower would make them do it. It is just imagination. It is an unfortunate thing that we have to call this imagination, because, particularly in the West, that indicates something fanciful, something unbelievable, and yet imagination is the strongest force on earth.